Ladies and gentlemen, good evening. Welcome to this evening's panel discussion on winning and losing from EU enlargement, politics and principles. The European Institute here at LSE is delighted that you could be with us here this evening. This particular panel is organized in conjunction with the European Parliament Information Office, and it's one in a series of events that the EU, the EEI has put on EU-related matters and is putting on. Let me just remind you that in this sequence we've got the President of the Commission, Mr. Barroso, appearing at the LSE on Friday. There is further information on the leaflets which have been handed out if you want to try and come along and hear him. I'm delighted this evening to be able to welcome two very distinguished guests from different parts of the policy world who have come to the LSE this evening to share their views on enlargement, perhaps the past, and hopefully also the future of this very important policy process in the EU. To my extreme left, Robert Cooper, I suppose his biggest current distinction is that he's a visiting professor here at the LSE. But apart from that, he, of course, has a long career of serving his country in the Foreign Office, both in the office here in London and at various posts abroad. But I suppose more interestingly and importantly for me, Robert has served both as counsellor to Cathy Ashton, the High Representative for CFSP, in 2010-2012, and also he's a former Director General for External and Political Military Affairs in the Council Secretariat for a long period of time. So he is somebody who knows the ins and outs of Brussels and the ins and outs of various aspects of external relations at the EU level, and he is a very competent person to have to speak about this issue of enlargement. To my immediate left, it's a great pleasure to welcome and introduce Lord Boswell. In his previous incarnation, political incarnation, I'd say, Tim Boswell was a Conservative MP, a long-serving Conservative MP for Daventry, I believe, for the best part of 27 years. He served both in government and in opposition in his time in the Commons in various positions. He's currently, in his most recent political incarnation in the Lords, chairman of the House of Lords EU Committee. And to those of you who don't know what the EU Committee in the House of Lords does, it is a very, very, very serious body that does sterling work. I myself have had the great privilege of serving as an advisor on one of these committees, and I can say that it's one of those committees that does very important work, both in terms of scrutiny and in terms of inquiries. And one of the most recent inquiries that his committee has produced under his chairmanship is an inquiry on EU enlargement, which I'm sure Lord Boswell will be saying a bit more about in his remarks. Our guests have agreed to speak for about 15 minutes each. Robert's going to kick off the presentations, and we'll have plenty of time for questions and answers afterwards. Let me just also let you know that at the end of this evening's discussion, you're all very welcome to come and join us for a drink across the road in the senior common room on the fifth floor of the old building where there's a small reception. So please do come and join us. There'll be stewards helping escort us across the way so we don't get lost. And those of you who are inclined to tweet and to enter the Twitter sphere, the hashtag is here, at LSE EU Enlarge. Feel free to comment and tweet yourselves to death during the next hour and a bit. So without further ado, welcome to our guests, and I'll hand over to Robert Cooper.
Right. Well, 15 minutes doesn't give you time to do much more than give a few headings and offer things that I hope will then provide food for discussion afterwards. So I think that I'm going to say, I think I've written down six headings, and so I'm going to say six things. That gives them about 3 minutes each. First, when you find yourself speaking at an event like this, which has got enlargement in the heading, it's almost certainly talking about the great enlargement, the enlargement that took place in 2000 and now, I have to get it right, 2004 and 2006. Actually, that, of course, is not the first time the EU is enlarged, because by that time, there were already, in 2004, there were already 15 member states, and there were originally six. So it had already more than doubled its size. And the earlier enlargements are also in a way interesting, but I'm not going to say very much about them. But they didn't happen by accident. They happened basically because there were people who wanted to join, but also because the EU itself, from time to time, either felt some kind of an obligation, or it was in some way stuck and needed to and wanted to do something different, and enlargement was what it did. The EU was in a fix at the time when the first big enlargement involving Britain took place. So it's been a process of mutual interest. But perhaps I will say in that, and this was advice I gave to actually to the Poles when they first started thinking about joining, one of the lessons of enlargement, if you are a kind of enlargee, is that you cannot negotiate with the European Union. And so what I said to the Poles is, I said, it's no use thinking that this is a negotiation. You can make some variation on the details, but basically you end up accepting what the EU has already decided on its own. So my advice to you is accept everything, do it as quickly as you can, and then renegotiate when you get in.
That's what we all do.
It's what we all do. Because when you're outside, you're extremely weak. When you're inside, your position is quite different. But it's not necessarily a very healthy way to do things. On the big enlargement, for me, this is the this was one of the two things which justify the EU's existence in geopolitical terms. The first thing that justifies the EU political in existence in political terms is the fact that it has been a part of the pattern which has brought an end to several centuries of wars in Europe. Now, it's no longer fashionable to say this, but it's true. It's not the whole of the story, because there are many other things going on as well, but I think that it's actually a very important part of the fact that nobody even considers wars now. That's the first big achievement of the EU. The second big achievement of the EU came, big strategic achievement, came with the big enlargement, because I do not believe that Central and Eastern Europe would have been so successful and so stable without it. Now, of course, lots of credit belongs to the countries of Central and Eastern Europe themselves. But I think that the ability to rather quickly become members of the EU, the ability to get, when you're in a kind of complete post-communist confusion and you don't know what to do, to take some off-the-peg legislation on regulation of different industries and things like that, I think was of enormous help to them in attracting investment. A lot of people I know who've invested there say to me, well, it was when we understood that they were going to be adopting the EU Act, we said to ourselves, we know how to deal with that, this country is now safe. That, and to some extent the pressures that the EU brought on countries to reform in different ways, I think were probably positive more than negative. We didn't get absolutely everything right. I think that we didn't put enough emphasis on the rule of law, on judicial institutions. This is rather silly of us, because if you ask what is the European Union, the answer is it's a community of law. What does it do? It makes laws. And therefore, having member states who can administer the law and have courts which will operate in an unbiased and professional way is actually central to the EU. And we should have paid more attention to that. And now, the next phase of enlargement is about the Balkans. As I said at another occasion that we were both at a few days ago, several of us were at, the EU had a big success in the 1990s, which was enlargement, and a big failure, which was the Balkans. Now we're trying to retrieve out the position of the failure. And the most important decision the EU made was the decision that the Balkans are Europe, and that, like it or not, we're going to take responsibilities. Like it or not, they're going to become members. And that, I think, was the moment at which the EU really started getting serious about solving the problems. Hasn't solved all the problems, but that's now... when I say the Balkans, I'm really talking about the ex-Yugoslavia, the Western Balkans. But that's now the agenda. Negotiations are underway with Montenegro. They will begin very shortly with Serbia. There is Macedonia, which is in a state with a little bit more, not luck, actually, with a bit more political courage, they could start to. But this is an area that is has got, let's say, a complicated history and a difficult reputation, and this process needs to be approached quite cautiously, thoroughly. Behind that, sort of just maybe on the horizon, if not over the horizon, there are two big further question marks, and that one is Turkey, and the other is Ukraine. And I won't say any more than that. There's lots of room for discussion of both of these very interesting, very important countries, actually vital countries in a way for Europe. If you were counting, I got to number three. No, that was number four, Turkey and Ukraine. Number five, there's a mythology in Britain and sometimes in Europe that there is some kind of choice that the EU has to make between widening and deepening. This is garbage. Actually, each widening has also brought deepening. Even if people didn't want it, like this country, it's always brought deepening. And as for the ones who didn't want widening, well, they've got it too. So these things are not... It's not that they're perfectly compatible. It's actually that one brings the other. When you bring in new member states, you bring in new problems and you look for new solutions, and that's a kind of deepening. But there is a bigger problem, which is that more member states is more difficult to organize, and so you need another kind of deepening. There is, I think, a longer term problem, and that is that at some point we ought to have a real serious look at the institutions, because the institutions were designed for six and they don't work that well. In fact, there is a lot that's really badly in need of reform. And then finally, that's point six. Everything you read in the press these days, a lot in this country, but in other countries as well, about the horrors of immigration is complete garbage. All serious work on the subject demonstrates, as far as this country is concerned, that immigration is a net benefit in terms of economics, in terms of budgets, in terms of social security payments, all of the things. Almost, if you want to know what the truth about immigration is, it's a good idea to read the certain newspapers and then believe the opposite. The other thing to know about it is that this is a two-way street, and there are just as many Brits abroad as there are Europeans in Britain. And the third thing is that, on the whole, the people who come, unhappily for some of the countries they come from, the people who come are tend to be better off, well-educated people who make a big contribution. And in a way, one ought to worry about whether it's bad for the countries they come from. But that's a different story, and that's not what is said in the press at all. And I would say from my own personal experience of the big enlargement, because I was then working in the Council Secretariat, that it was a kind of big discovery to find that I had always believed that there were two Europes, that there was the Europe of Guten Tag in different forms and the Europe of Buongiorno, also in different forms, with one or two eccentrics like, I forget what you say in
Kalamea,
like, or Hyvapäivä, and the kind of fringe eccentrics in Europe. But broadly speaking, Europe seemed to fall into those, and we then discovered that this was not the truth at all, and that there is also the Europe of Dzień Dobry, and the different. And it was, for me, it was a net enrichment of my life to find that, to make friends. It added more variety. Variety is good. It's creative. Bringing people together from different cultures produces very interesting results. I could go on at great length about what fun it is to work in the European Union, but actually it's the mixture of histories, cultures, prejudices, national characters. The display of national character you get in Brussels is really wonderful to behold. So.
Thank you very much, Robert, for coming in under your 15 or 20 minutes as well. I don't think I've ever been described as a fringe eccentric before my nationality, but I'll take that as a compliment. Lord Boswell.
Yes, I think we'd better defend the chair by saying virtually the whole of this discourse is mediated through English, but actually the underlying concepts come from his country. One should remember that. Thank you for the opportunity of coming and joining a platform with Robert Cooper. I'm going to start, like good preachers do, with a few more or less unrelated facts to which you might like to pay attention. The first one is strictly for students of the entirely inconsequential, accidental facts of history, but some of you may have observed that both speakers tonight were both born in Brentwood. And now if this has any significance politically, I'm not sure what it is, but I mention it. Then can I throw in one or two other points that I think might draw your attention? The first one is there have been 7 enlargements to date of the European Union. Montenegro and Serbia, now coming as candidate countries in negotiations, would be the likely future accessions. Which was the largest of those enlargements? It was actually the first. The British and the Danes and the Irish were participant, it's in our report, in the largest enlargement. And that makes a point, I think, which is that it has always been possible to see off the scoffers, the people who say there's enlargement fatigue, there's accession fatigue. You can manage it if you want to do it. Secondly, from the fact that there are now countries engaged in negotiations, and 6 more, mainly in the Western Balkans, but also including Turkey, wanting to join at some stage and accepted within that, that there is a pipeline which continues. And thirdly, as you will have seen from the events on the streets in Ukraine, there is a very strong interest in further enlargement. And that brings me to perhaps one of the underlying points I would make, and I think it is unfashionable. It's been mirrored in something Robert said. I think there is a moral issue about all this, as well as a purely prudential one, which is European values, the strength of diversity, and the way in which we find that we can do things together. I may say that one of the most eloquent advocates of enlargement in evidence to our committee is an MEP, perhaps it should be nameless, although it will be on the record, sent us a very short piece of evidence and said that he was entirely in favour of further enlargement, provided, of course, that the United Kingdom made room for the new entrants. Well, you can read that as a double-edged sword. Those are all my introductory remarks. If we go back in history, I mean, I think Robert has rightly identified the hard points of this, the hard points of achievement. The first one was, I think, simply the statement understood by Monnet and others that the European Union was a better way of engaging with your neighbours and doing business than the methods which had been adopted historically and acutely during the first half of the 20th century. War was not the way for France and Germany to coexist, nor for their neighbours. And that has been a success in that that is now more or less unthinkable. And the second moral high point could be called either the vendor when the wall fell and the political values of Western Europe were transferred or expressed in the other half of Europe for the first time, leading eventually to an accession process. And that was pretty bloody and pretty incomplete for the point, because of the points that have been made about the Western Balkans. But it was a very major achievement. And it also, looking at the High Commissioner there, had the interesting byproduct of bringing in two British Commonwealth countries, which we tend to forget, which I celebrate. So there was a moral case. The other bit of the moral case I make, because at moments of depression, and there are some in this job, I find it necessary occasionally to get the treaties out, but I would not recommend you to read Article 50 unless you really fear the worst. If you're a Daily Mail reader, perhaps you should be reading Article 50 all the time. It might even cheer you up. But Article 49 talks about accession for all states that accept the values. And do spend a little time, and I was advising a senior European official the other day to do it, having a look at Article 2, which is about the values, because I think they matter, they are common. And if ever HMS Europe goes under the waves finally, I will just leave you with the thought that I, for one, will be asking if we can at least have confirmation from what is then Her Majesty's government that we still subscribe to the values of Article 2, because it seems to me they are unexceptionable and they're central to European culture. So much for preliminaries. Now, when we did our inquiry, perhaps I should just fill in with what the Michelin guide would call un peu d'histoire. How the House of Lords did it, I'm not quite sure, but I think one or two powerful individuals were instrumental in it. But we took to ourselves, on British accession in 1974, the role of scrutiny. Now, there is a House of Commons procedure, and I'm not demeaning that now or wishing to say anything about it, but we set up a structure which is essentially subsisted from over the last 40 years of British membership, which is that there is an EU Select Committee, which I chair, and then there is a family of peers. It's actually 75 in round terms, so it's about 10% of the strength of the House, who participate in the various subcommittees that generate the various reports, or we do them centrally in our overarching committee where they are of constitutional or general importance. We have a staff of about 25, so some people say we operate as an interesting and slightly unusual think tank, and I think that's what we do, actually, alongside and often arising out of our work in scrutiny. Well, we have had the Commission's reports annually on enlargement prospects. They are detailed. They deal with the particular countries as they are rolling out. And we escalated or built on that scrutiny role to say we'll do a more thematic report on the future of enlargement, which we published about 12 months ago, but it's obviously germane to tonight. And probably I ought to say at the beginning that the only reservation I had about the report we produced was that it seemed to be rather widely acceptable to people. I mean, when you get a nice letter back from the Foreign Office saying, well, we agree, really, you know, my political instinct says, you know, what's the catch in this? Have we really soft-pedaled that too much? But there seemed to be a view that we had got it reasonably right, and I think in fairness, seeing one or two of their ambassadors and other representatives here, I think that was, on the whole, the view of other countries represented in London. Well, what we said, I think the first point you have to start with is the Copenhagen criteria. Before this process, unlike Robert, I think I had to be quietly briefed as to what they are, and I will give you my account of them. They are that an applicant country that has made an application should be one politically stable should have political and democratic institutions, two, that it should have a functioning market economy, and three, that it should be prepared to accept the acquis. Well, it's as simple as that. And that is the gateway, and if you accept those, you're in the process. There will be countries, member states, who tend or wish, or would not like to say in public, but will do their best to subvert your accession. I can only perhaps give one example historically, but the Turkish application was, if I recall, filed in 1963. So there's been a long period of consideration of that matter, and for reasons which the High Commissioner will know well and are not, in my view, subsisting in his community, I'm not saying that, many chapters of that negotiation have not yet been opened. But those criteria, which are very general, seem to me entirely sensible. The second point we made, and I was rather derided by one or two of the more literate members of the committee for saying it, because I drafted it myself, was if conditionality is to work, it has to be genuinely conditional. In other words, if you're going to set rules which, as it were, amplify the three Copenhagen criteria from the Commission to carry out a negotiation with you, there has to be a genuine understanding that you need to meet those rules, and when you've met them, you can close those chapters and go on to the next. And at the end of the process, there will be a high likelihood that you will be able to accede. Now, there are two problems in that, which are, in a sense, come together. We did report on this in some detail, and again, I'm not looking at Cyprus to single them out, but they were mentioned in this. We were attacked about equally by both communities, so probably we got it about right. But we said, don't do another Cyprus. Because you should get your bilateral issues sorted out before you join. Actually, I don't think you have necessary to resolve them at the beginning of the negotiation. There is an interesting process to consider, for example, with Macedonia in due course, as to where you time it. It's often pointed out by one of my colleagues with the British accession, we were in dispute with the Irish Republic about the constitutional status of Northern Ireland through the whole course of that negotiation, and it was agreed that it should be parked and resolved by an exchange of letters at the conclusion of the negotiation. It doesn't really matter how you do it, in my view, but you do need to have a process. I think in many cases, I mean, bearing in mind that there is still, for example, a territorial dispute, I think, on the maritime border between Croatia and Montenegro, you probably need to say, we will agree that we'll put this into arbitration or some other process that we can deal with it. Robert may be looking distressed.
No, I mean, whatever the dispute is, it's almost certainly materially irrelevant in the real world.
But it will exercise people hugely. Yeah. And if I may say, and the last time I was in LSE was when President Anastasiades spoke, it will generate huge ghosts from the past that come up in questions. You understand that. It's very tough. The second thing is that, as Robert has said, you bring up your Justice and Home Affairs chapters early. And I always say to people from applicant countries, don't think this is just a reputational issue because we want to get it right. Actually, it's cardinal to the whole. The rule of law is central to your economic development as well as to your social and cultural respectability in this club. You need to show that you have the mechanism working right. And then you have, of course, to do the really terribly boring job of translating and implementing the acquis. 43,000 pages, I think, currently. The Montenegrins have a head start. They may have a population about one-third of that of Essex, as we mentioned, that county. But on the other hand, they do have at least a common language which they would call Montenegrin and their neighbours would call Serbian and their near neighbours would call Serbo-Croat or Croatian. And they've got it. But it's a start. And so the negotiations proceed. And they should reach a conclusion. And they shouldn't be sidetracked by issues like migration, though there do need to be assurances and there do need to be transitional periods. And slightly in the spirit of what Robert was saying earlier, you do need to have regard to the particular interests of countries coming in, and you do need, if necessary, to organise transitional periods that will meet those concerns. Looking at issues that are tough, I mention and park the Ukraine, because I think that will come up in questions, and that is not in any way an applicant country. I mention and park Turkey, which is an applicant country, but will have to be addressed. I do emphasise the importance of getting justice and home affairs up early. I do emphasise the importance of making sure that the conditions are properly met. Two points that I would just single out looking forward. We did talk a bit about the funds for the Instrument for Pre-Accession Assistance, IPA. I don't think that the community got this quite right to start with. There will be a new iteration with a new commission, and I think they need to think about that. What I'd like to see is rather more emphasis on regional self-help and cooperation between member countries, rather than looking bilaterally at what you need to do. Because, I mean, anything that will encourage countries to work together, looking at infrastructure, common functions and so forth, is a very important part of Jean Monnet's concept of engrenage, conducted at a local level, and it's beginning to show value to those countries. I think we should also remember that when we're requiring strict adherence to the benchmarks, we shouldn't impose standards that we're not prepared to impose on ourselves. I mean, it's interesting, and I won't dilate on it tonight, there are some concerns about the integrity of the British electoral system and postal voting, and this is why we're going to single voter identification, for example. We're not perfect, and we shouldn't expect other countries that are applicants to be judged by higher standards than ourselves. I mean, one might have a reference recently, although that is defensible, not tonight, to Italian court procedures, for example. But, you know, we must not ask for more, but we should, in good faith, ask for what is appropriate to be a European standard. I'm just going to close with two points, and they're unrelated, but I think in a sense they focus on this. This issue about enlargement will not go away, even if some of the larger countries are not keen on it. Britain has a very honourable record in promoting enlargement, and I think that's a positive for this country, and we should continue with it. We will have lots of allies in Central and Eastern Europe, widely interpreted. I was very impressed the other day hearing Foreign Minister Venizelos, for example, talking not only about his commitment, but also that it meant that he was happy to go to Ankara, he'd been to Skopje. It wasn't just on paper that he was prepared to do the business. And I thought that was quite moving. But I close, actually, it'll be a double header on two little experiences I've had in the last 12 months, which, to me, validate the process. What I'm sure the French, if they were here, would call, though they might not agree with it, Europe's enlargement vocation. But I'm going to start with one. I happened to be there taking evidence from Commissioner Foulet with my select committee in December 2012 for the enlargement inquiry, and he came in with a piece of paper and said, we've had talks today between Dačić and Thatcher. This is the agreement we've now reached. 6 or 7 points. That is what is called in the trade transformational power. And I mean, that wouldn't have happened if there'd been no European Union anymore. We wish your talks very well. It's in the context of the European interest. Second point I want to make, and I mean, I think in a way it brings us back to where we started, which was the chaos of the Second World War. I have a Lithuanian MP friend who actually lost most of his own family in the camps. But when I was over on Cossack business because of the Lithuanian presidency in Vilnius, he said, you have seen the broken window, have you, in the parliament? And I said, no, nobody's shown me that here. And you look up in this rather nice stained glass hall, as it's called, and there at the top pane is a broken window. And you've probably read all this stuff about New York police departments and how you shouldn't, you know, leave things like that to go wrong because that shows you don't care. And I thought, well, that's an interesting thing to do. And he said, well, I'll tell you the background. We were all MPs, and we were some of us younger than we are now. And that's the last shot the Red Army fired at us. Well, I find it very difficult to be cynical about that.
Yeah.
And in the end, you know, despite the fact that cynicism is our trait, I don't think we should be cynical about enlargement.
Right.
Thank you both very much indeed. A rather positive outlook, rather than usual gloomy outlook to do with enlargement, which is interesting to say the least, and I hope it will stimulate an interesting set of questions and discussion from the audience. There is a microphone. There are microphones available for those who wish to ask questions and or perhaps make short comments. Please do identify yourselves before asking your question or making your comment, and we'll start with the gentleman here.
Hello, good evening. My name is Konstantinos Kouloucheris. I'm a third-year student in Journalism and Communication Studies. I'm from Greece. My question has to do, following your perceptions on the EU enlargement, whether is it really wise to talk, to go through, like, in the coming European elections for the European Parliament, while the situation at the moment in Europe is we have a crisis, a social crisis. We have the South and the North. The Southern economies are struggling to cope in a way, so we have a 2 year currency and everything else. How the new members will adapt to the situation? Thank you.
Should we take one more question as well? We'll answer together. Somebody else had their hand up over here. No? I saw somebody had their hand up. Okay. I'm not sure I understood exactly what your question was about, but let me try and paraphrase it, perhaps.
I'm just asking. My question is whether it's wise to proceed to an enlargement at the moment that the current situation in the Eurozone doesn't really function. In a way. Yeah.
Okay, well, let's put enlargement in the context of the current Eurozone crisis and Euro crisis.
Exactly.
And see what your thoughts are on that. Robert?
Well, the negotiations with Croatia took 8 years, and negotiations with Serbia and Montenegro will probably take the same kind of time. I mean, it's not in a way the negotiations that take the time, it's the programs of domestic reform that are required for membership. And I hope that by the time, I hope that the euro crisis is going to be resolved long before that. So I don't think that there's a problem. I don't think that we should stop doing everything because of the crisis in the Eurozone. The objective ought to be to deal with the crisis in the Eurozone, to deal with the social crisis that you quite rightly describe as alarming in many ways. But that doesn't stop us from looking further ahead beyond that, I think is my answer.
Well, I think I agree with that general comment. I just make the general point that whereas what the French would call les trente glorieuses, the 30 glorious years of expansion and prosperity after the conclusion of the Treaty of Rome, will not return in the near future and therefore are not an argument in accession, there is still a strong appetite for continuing membership in countries like Greece, despite the real horrible pressures they're under with 60% youth unemployment, for example. And there is also a wish for other countries to accede. There's an interesting technical issue, which we do talk about in this a bit. You don't have to go very far through the Lisbon Treaty to find that I think it's Article 3 from memory, that the currency of the European Union will be the euro. Well, we discussed that, and I mean, that is a commitment and aspiration. It is not actually deliverable, or certainly not deliverable at the moment of accession, because there is no end point. I mean, nobody is saying you have to be a member 5 years after accession or anything like that. And therefore, that means that some countries may well join that are not Euro or not intending to be Euro members. Interestingly, of course, the next applicant is Montenegro, which is a Euro user without actually being a Euro member. I've heard some rather batty suggestions, including that you might actually have to leave in order to rejoin, but leave that aside. There is, behind your question, I think, some serious issue about, first of all, how you produce an economic governance which is more responsive to the needs of citizens. And secondly, how you produce a euro area which can be adequately run, particularly as it is now at 18 and will be, even if it's not at 28 now, there will be a growing membership. And I think we do have institutional questions to look at that. I will not answer them tonight, but I will trail the report which my committee is just issuing this week on genuine economic and monetary union. That is on the back of a huge amount of work by one of our subcommittees, and it is saying unfinished business yet.
Yes.
But you may wish to read it when it comes out. It will be on the website.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Walter Czerny from the European Institute. Could I ask you to perhaps reconcile or discuss your very different view about conditionality and its role? I mean, Robert Cooper basically said conditionality is a fiction. A country should just accept it, go in, and then renegotiate. In other words, also saying countries don't change that much through the process. While you, Lord Boswell, said, you know, make it a real condition, a real hurdle, and use it as a lever for change that you want to see. I think the official version is more in line with Lord Boswell, but in the literature there is a debate about what a myth conditionality is. So I would be curious what you two say, because we still apply a lot of conditionality.
It's not what I meant to convey.
Okay.
What I meant to convey is actually, I think, rather in line with what Lord Boswell said, which is, actually, there's no choice. You're going to have to accept these conditions anyway. Don't think you can negotiate them. Just accept the lot. Do it. Now, and then renegotiate later. What I mean by that is, that doesn't mean that you can renegotiate the structure of your judicial system or whatever else it is. That means things like something has been imposed on you that is not absolutely necessary by the acquis. If you want a classical case for that, it's not the British rebate and the budget. British budgetary question, it's actually the common fisheries policy as it was imposed on the UK. It's never been implemented happily, because it was if the common fisheries policy had been as it was, there was going to be one common area of sea in which everybody could fish, and that was basically entirely unfair and has never happened. So that's really what I meant. Now, those cases are not going to occur that often. But what I was really saying is, there isn't actually any choice. You're going to have to accept all this stuff. Don't think you can escape. Now, get in and renegotiate. Well, if there's something that is really bad for you, then you'll do that. But mostly, it's not like that.
Yeah, if I could just add a couple of points. We're always children of our last bad experience. And I think the last accession left an untidiness. A good friend, the Bulgarian ambassador, is here. And it led to the imposition ex post entry of the CVM mechanism. I don't think anyone wants to do that again. We'd rather get it right to start with. And I think it would not be acceptable for the Commissioner negotiating not to have this ordered process. Lots of the political instinct about this, I think, would be different and responsive. I'm I remember thinking at the moment when the Salazar and Franco regimes fell in in Iberia, you know, get your guys out there, tell them they're welcome, you know, bring them in. But you couldn't do that now, and probably you shouldn't expect to, and I think it's a realistic appraisal. But what you mustn't do is pretend to go through the process of negotiation in ill faith and then slam the door when somebody's actually met the reasonable obligations that you impose on them.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. My name is Euripides. I'm the High Commissioner of Cyprus. Thank you for inciting and scintillating debate on the enlargement. I think nobody disagrees with the fundamentals, i.e., when one changes the context, then the some problems are changed. As Jean Monnet would say, you change the context, you change the problem. And I think the major landmark of the European Union has always been to extend the zone of peace and stability and predictability based on the rule of law to the countries that it has engulfed. Yeah. And I think that in itself does wonders. I think the most successful experiment in human history, despite the many faults that the European Union is going through, and euro crisis or no euro crisis, I think in the end we will be strengthened. Do we have, of course, we all agree that it is a community of values. Do we have any geographical definitions to this? Would it be fair to make geographical definitions as to where Europe is? I mean, and why not extend it as much as it can be extended, and at some point bringing in Russia, bringing in any country that adheres to democracy, human rights, the rule of law, and to the acquis? Do we have any? Because very often that aspect of enlargement is said that, listen, this is as far as we can go, and let's do some more deepening, let's see what the people are asking. And to the Cyprus question, which was just a brief comment and I finish, I think the catalyst effects sometimes does not work immediately the way we want it. But if it was not for the European Union, but I know that my country would be in a much worse situation than what it is now, and it is in fact the catalyst that opened up a door today with the agreement of a joint communique between the two leaders in order to move forward. And I think it has to do with the European Union. More than 40 million visits across the ceasefire line, incident-free. And I think that speaks volumes. Mm. It has to do with the European Union. Well, the issue is much more complicated, but I wanted to raise that, and I want to thank you.
Right. We did debate in our committee before we came to our report whether there should be a kind of geographical limes to Europe. I mean, whether it's the Oder-Neisse line or the Bug or the Dnieper or whatever. And we thought there shouldn't be. And, I mean, indeed, there is no formal text in the treaty suggesting that it should be. It's basically a state that accepts the values of Article 2 may make application. It is then, of course, for member states to adjudicate on that. And there are technical problems if, say, Serbia, Kosovo, for example, if one comes in and then can slam the door on the other. So, or indeed, dare I say, if Britain decided to react extremely negatively to a Scottish referendum and just said, well, you're not coming in, or alternatively, we'll leave and then you can go in. I mean, please don't get into that territory. That is hypothetical. But I think any state that has a reasonable connection with Europe and accepts the values and can meet the Copenhagen criteria and the conditionality could join. And that, of course, includes Ukraine. I think it's more difficult to look at it in terms of Russia. But if I can just say one thing, and I meant to say in my remarks about Russia-Ukraine, I think probably collectively we missed a trick for understandable reasons in relation to the Eastern Partnerships. And you have to say, in terms of public awareness in Britain, this, the Eastern Partnership, and as you move down into the Helenophone sphere of influence, also the Southern Partnership, are not so well understood here. And I do track a little bit Russia. And I mean, we've reported on Russia some years before my chairmanship. And I think we don't quite understand the need for Russia to reassert itself as a great power. And we need to think how we can accommodate that. and whether we could have done it not over the body of Ukraine, but in terms of a better understanding, rather than, as it were, say, of course they'll accede to us because it's in their interests, as if it were inimical to Russian interests if they did. I think we've not quite developed the debate. That's not lost. We've had our Penneth at our last meeting. We said we've all put in to leave the democratic door open and eventually to accession to EU for Ukraine. But it is going to take a lot longer. And it's only an index of the complexity of the remaining problems. I mean, I said Britain was the biggest accession. And God knows it was difficult enough at the time because I did understand the CAP in those days. But it's easy peasy compared with Ukraine now, of course.
I have to admit that I haven't got the Lisbon Treaty off by heart. The old treaty, the one that I used to know well, said membership is open to any European country.
It did say.
And that's gone, has it?
No, I think it still says Europe, but the point is that there's no definition of Europe.
Right.
I mean, and after all, yes. Guadeloupe is participant, for example.
Well, I'm sure New Zealand would. I always thought Japan would make quite a good member in a way, but supposing, I mean, there is. I have no doubt that the EU decided at some point that Turkey was a European country, and I don't mind idea. There, on the basis that Europe is what Europe does. Maybe the day will come when Tunisia will point to the extensive Roman remains they have and say, and Libya has got even more, but the day is probably a bit further off. And say, we have a great European heritage in our country. Syria certainly does as well. I think that will cause a debate in Europe. Ridiculously, there's been a debate in Europe about whether Ukraine is a European country, which is actually, it's scandalous that anybody should question that. There is a sense in which Russia is a European country. That's also clear. Anybody who thinks that that Chekhov and Dostoevsky and Shostakovich and these great figures are not part of European culture. Now, I have reservations about thinking about Russia as a member because I think of, there's another sense of European which is not cultural, but which is kind of political diplomatic, which tells me that this is a continent of small states. And not of great empires. And so I would hesitate myself, although generally being enthusiastic about enlargement if it's properly done, I would hesitate about Moscow quite a lot. But for the rest, it's perfectly clear that Ukraine is a European country. It's also perfectly clear that Ukraine is nowhere near meeting anything like the Copenhagen criteria. But I think we ought to be ready to give them the assurance that if they did, and that already will be a long struggle for them, but if they did, then they can apply like anybody else. But I wondered if I could slightly reverse the procedure. And we have one ambassador and one high commissioner here. I wonder if the panel... another two ambassadors. Found a member, so not quite the same.
But
I wondered if we could pose a question to them. A question that because it seems to me that one of the interesting things about enlargement is not just the process of joining, but it's what happens to you after you join. And I'm very struck, I don't know what's happened to Britain, that someone else can judge that, but I'm very struck by the way in which Ireland blossomed as a member of the EU and stopped being an embittered ex-bit of Britain and found it was a country in its own right and was equal to Britain, and it was extraordinarily good for British-Irish relations.
Absolutely.
But I wondered if but even the Luxembourg view would be interesting too. But I wonder if the High Commissioner and the Ambassador have got anything to say about how they think being a member has changed their countries. Not just the process of getting there, but what happens after you join.
Can I give you a couple of minutes to think about that while I take a few more questions? Right. Some people have been waiting.
Can I just very quickly intervene for a second, picking up what Robert said? First of all, to quote, the only Soviet-era quote I ever make is Vyacheslav Molotov's remark. The trouble with democratic elections is you can never be quite sure who's going to win, which is why he was rather against them. The second point I want to make now, and it's not simply because we have, as it were, representatives of some of the smaller European Union countries, but and I sometimes warn off, as it were, French and German friends as well. We can't run Europe as a directoire. I mean, there may be advantages in squaring issues between large countries, but I think one of the stimulating facts of enlargement is that it has brought in significant numbers of countries which are relatively small population, but are still part of this. I mean, if you look at the immediate impression of the Lithuanian presidency, for example, they did a first-rate job on limited resources at the geographic edge of Europe, and I think that is entirely to be commended. I'm sorry,
thank you very much. Rant. There are at least three or four people who've got their hands up, and I'd like to take those questions so we give them a chance. The gentleman in the middle here first. We'll take them all together. Perhaps you can pick and choose what you want to answer.
Thank you. Thank you for your discussion. It's insightful. I'm Alexander Sim. I'm a master's student in international relations. I'd like to add to the lady's question before, but with regard to Bosnia, and that's what is to be done where the mismanagement of conditionality leads local elites to believe that conditionality is negotiable. For instance, with regard to the stabilization and association agreement, how can the European Union revive its credibility, the credibility of its conditionality in that sort of circumstance?
Thank you very much. Gentleman here.
Thank you. My name is Ulf Samuelsson from the northern fringe of Europe, representing the Embassy of Sweden. I wanted to pick up on what Mr. Cooper said in the beginning about the immigration debate here in the UK. And considering the fact that the UK government has been a staunch supporter of EU enlargement for quite some time, do you have any fears, or how do you see the coming months, the coming years, when it comes to the immigration debate, and that is that impacting the UK position on enlargement? And if so, I mean, what could be done? And actually, I was thinking about Bosnia as well, and I was just picking up on what the gentleman said here. I was wondering, is there, when it comes to Bosnia, is there too much of a push from the EU at the moment? Is there? The Bosnian leaders just doesn't seem to actually want to pursue a European path. Are we expecting too much? Thank you.
Yeah. And the gentleman at the back there.
I am Josh Baines, and I work in political communications. It's kind of picking up off the previous point, actually. So I think it's fair to say there's quite a dichotomy growing at the moment between the desire for enlargement into Eastern Europe, while a number of the Western and original members struggle with a huge amount of crisis of confidence in the EU. Talk about the Euroscepticism and the immigration debate in the UK and France, as well as the economic crises in Portugal, Spain and Italy. Whereas we haven't got a breakdown yet, there are some, albeit tenuous, parallels between the breakdown of the Roman Empire a long time ago. And I just wanted to ask the panel, based on this growing dichotomy, if the trends continue, how does enlargement have to accommodate the reality of membership for a number of the Western states at the moment that are struggling to come to terms with their current membership? And finally, do you see at any point, if these trends continue unabated, any shift in political or cultural power towards the Eastern states as the Western states grapple with the idea of membership in itself?
So the questions of Bosnia, questions of immigration, questions of the new Europe a la Donald Rumsfeld.
Well, I think we've worked on diversion of responsibilities. Robert's going to do Bosnia, but can I respond to the other two? On migration, let me just tell you with a straight face what I told the negotiator for one of the two current applicant countries engaged in negotiation, Montenegro, actually. I said, I would not lose too much sleep about what you read in the papers today. That is my view. I think it's an epiphenomenon. It's part of the wider British argument about Euroscepticism and how you deal with the European parliamentary elections this year. It is perhaps no accident that any engagement in terms of future effects would be some 6 years forward from now for the reasons we've given. Yeah. And that's my view of it. On the question of, you know, as it were, intra-European geopolitical forces, I mean, one of the first points I make is there's a universal adoption of English, which is quite remarkable. It was not perhaps wholly an accident, I now gather, because I think Mrs. Thatcher, for one, was very keen on pushing this agenda as part of the enlargement agenda. Number two, there's a very strong commitment in the accession 10 countries to single market and liberal trading. And my personal view is that there will be much stronger advantages for those countries coming in with very low national incomes through exposure to a free market, providing it's properly controlled and conditioned, so that they can trade abroad and get the benefits. And you will get, you look at, for example, the recovery of Latvia from a really searing period economically has been quite striking. I've seen some of the examples in Lithuania of entrepreneurs operating, and it is very encouraging. As regards whether it alters the balance in Europe, I don't think it will, because of the reality of population. I mean, there will still be very big countries, UK, Germany, France, Italy, Spain. But I think the one to watch is clearly Poland, because they are a populous country. They have a large slew of natural resources, even though those are potentially polluting. But they also have at least some resilience, which is coming through, and I think they will take their place. But remembering again my final point, this isn't a zero-sum game in which it's going to be either seemly or necessary for the six big countries to gang up on all the other members.
My answers are all going to be quite short anyway, because that's the way they normally are. But I'm going to say one word about the euro crisis, which perhaps I didn't deal with properly before. And that is, I didn't come here planning to talk a lot about the euro crisis. I actually think that this is extremely serious. I don't think it's over at all. I think that it poses real dangers for the European Union. As I wrote somewhere or other once, this fish rots not from the head but from the tail. If this becomes live again, then what I fear is not some crisis in Brussels, it's a crisis in Athens or Madrid or something like that. Yeah. And that, unfortunately, is still perfectly possible. But I'm not expert enough, therefore I think the questions that people have raised about the euro crisis are very serious. It's just that I don't know how to answer them. That's why I passed on and carried and moved on to subjects I do know about. But for the moment, our working assumption is that the necessary institutions to handle the euro are going to be developed. It's not happening as quickly as it ought to, is all I can say, and the process is probably going to be very painful. So I think there is a real danger to the European Union, and it's called, unfortunately, the euro. I think the commitment for among those in charge to solve the problem is very large, but I don't know whether they're going to succeed, and I don't know whether they're going to be in charge. I think it's the last one is the problem. But I think that the EU ought to reflect about how it got itself into this mess as well, because this was a very badly designed piece of something which is critical and which can actually ruin the most successful thing that Europe's ever done. And I'm not, you may have worked out that I'm basically rather pro-European. I just wish that we'd done this better. Is there a power shift towards the east with enlargement? No, not yet. The real story is that because of the euro crisis, there's a power shift towards Germany. That's the only power shift that's taken place. The question on Bosnia, I think maybe I translate the two questions together as asking, are we trying too hard? And maybe the answer to that is yes. There are some problems that outsiders can't solve. That's what all of the kids are out in the streets on Bosnia today talking about. That can't be solved in Brussels. It can't be solved by conditionality. You're right, lots of people cheat on conditionality. I think the only thing I'd say on that is that cheating on conditionality you can get away with if you're quite distant. As you get closer and closer to enlargement, the EU becomes more and more serious about it and will not accept cheating on conditionality now, particularly with the history. It's because Bosnia is 1,000 miles away from joining the EU that it makes less fuss at the moment. Is our policy on Bosnia right? Well, no, it hasn't succeeded. But that's not our fault. That's because of the corruption of Bosnian politics. And we haven't got a cure for that.
Thank you very much.
One final question over
and
here.
Then we get the
and then perhaps we have the ambassadors to have their 2 minutes piece on answering Robert Cooper's question.
Milan Akubat.
Arkham or maybe someone else. I do not understand that there's someone from the audience before us.
There's somebody asking a question.
Milan Akubat, a student at the European Institute. I have two questions, if possible. First is on how do you assess the supranational decision-making structure in a union that's almost doubled in size over the last 10 years? And what do you see any problems with the favoring of a status quo with regard to the single market, for example, as the potential for veto player growth? And another question is on Ukraine, which came up a few times, is whether you can explain the position of the USA, which recently caused a bit of turmoil. And how the US would assess the EU's role with regard to Ukraine at the moment.
Okay, thank you very much. Perhaps you can split these questions. You can answer the first and you can answer the question. Second.
I think the first question, if I remember, was about economic development and size.
Decision-making.
I think Robert is right that the institutions have not been... They have not had a thorough service since they were developed. One of the difficulties... I mean, you might say, if you turn this round, I'm no apologist for the Commission or anyone else... It slightly indicates that they were quite well conceived in the first place, because no badly conceived institution could possibly be operating on the back of an expansion from 6 members to 28, let alone 35 or whatever the prospect is. So they were quite well put together. But they are no longer fully fit for purpose. And I don't think this means you can't make decisions, which is what I slightly worried about. And, of course, may have been part of the agenda of some people who wanted enlargement as a kind of a politique de pire to make things go badly wrong. I think the problem is you get suboptimal decisions. You always fudge things rather than doing the right thing. And that's the argument for example, a smaller commission, thinking of ways in which you can still represent the smaller states. And you can communicate more effectively with your electorates. All that has got rather difficult.
I'll leave the other question to Robert.
What was the other question?
Good question. It was
the other question was on Ukraine and US.
Ah, yeah. Right. Victoria Nuland. Ah, yeah. Well, she's a good friend. And what people say to each other in private conversations is not intended for being published, and one shouldn't take it too seriously. I don't think that either the EU or the United States is going to be able to solve the problems of Ukraine. Problems of Ukraine, like the problems of Bosnia, essentially will have to be solved by Ukrainian people themselves. I believe that the European Union can powerfully help that process if the right people are there wanting to do the right things. More powerfully, actually, than the United States. I think that we are, to be honest, more important than the USA. But I also, in this particular question, but I also think that a bit more strategic thinking is needed about Ukraine from some of the member states. I don't think, if this is over the horizon as far as enlargement is concerned, they don't even meet the Copenhagen criteria. But our interest in having a Ukraine which meets European standards is much bigger than all of the, I mean, this ridiculous debate about whether it's a European country.
If you look so, at so it's also in Russia's interest. I think,
yes, I think it's in Russia's interest, because I think the only thing that really, the shock of Russia seeing Ukraine, which was working well, meeting successful, would be enormous.
Yeah.
Nothing else would have such an impact on Russia. So in geopolitical terms, I think that we ought to be ready to do it, but no free lunches. They've got a massive and difficult job to do to reform themselves.
Okay, thank you very much. Could we ask their excellencies to say just a few words in response to Robert's question, and then we'll wrap it up then.
I'm delighted to attend this highly enlightening discussion. I'll be very much to the point. Giving a different interpretation about the role of negotiations, I would say that they are worthwhile being conducted in a very hard and competent way by aspirant countries. There are certain failures in the process and at the end of the road, chapter by chapter, as well as there are certain comparative advantages that may not have been achieved had the negotiating team on the part of the applicant country performed badly. Mm-hmm. Definitely, I share the view of our distinguished panelists that the opening of the GHA-related chapters, the two of them, early on in the accession process is something far better than the non-opening or de facto non-opening during the, in the earlier stages, leaving it for the last phase and thereafter attaching something like the CVM.
Yeah.
In two words, that's a good change, and probably should even be better if it could be coupled with a post-accession CVM type of monitoring mechanisms for all member states.
Interesting.
That's an idea launched by the Dutch and other European nations. We as a country subscribe to this.
Yeah.
It is important to find a solution to all bilateral issues, A, before the start of the accession talks, and on certain less important points after those talks have started. The excellent example of Cyprus, including today, should be, I'm afraid, seen as an exclusion rather than as a recipe for future approaches with regard to bilateral issues. And final point on the timetable for reform, A, for candidates, B, for negotiating countries. If we learn lessons from the Eurozone situation, if we take a look at the Maastricht criteria in the Stability and Growth Pact and the economic semester, the aspirant countries, the candidates, and the negotiating countries should embark on far more drastic, radical economic and financial reform we started back in the 1990s. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Excellent.
Very good.
Your excellence.
It's your turn.
Well, thank you very much. I'm happy to be here tonight and to listen to this debate, which even as representing a country which is a founding member is very interesting, I must say. Even if it is the difference between being a founding member of a group or then joining this group, I mean, for Luxembourg, it was certainly an experience in the 50s, as it was for many other countries since. We have become relevant. We have found a group where we could have our sovereignty protected. When you're mentioning the Guten Tag and the Bonjour, or let's say the Guten Tag and the Bonjour countries, there was a tiny country in between, which is still in between, and which very often was crushed in history because these two neighbors had fight. So for Luxembourg, it was a huge step forward for its own fate. Where we have become relevant showed each time when the enlargement was prepared, because we got visits from representatives of these countries who wanted to know how a small country like Luxembourg was just surviving or coping or existing in this ever-growing union. And we, I hope, managed to convince these countries that this was the right thing to do. And like you mentioned Ireland before. I mean, Luxembourg certainly, in co-founding the EU, the EEC at that time, was going through the same sort of experience, becoming really independent, much more as we used to be until 1940. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed.
Speaking right after the colleague from Luxembourg, my task is easier because my current minister, who was minister before joining, he said Luxembourg for us is the example. Look at Luxembourg. Even in history, we had some similarities in the sense that the more territory they took away from Luxembourg, the greater the title was. Luxembourg, Duchy of Luxembourg, then Grand Duchy of Luxembourg. And if Cyprus were in that neighborhood, if Cyprus were Benelux-Cyp, I'm sure our history would have been different. But we are where we are. Eastern Mediterranean, which is of cardinal importance for the security of the EU, being a member actually gave us security in the insecure environment that we are in, on the island and outside the island. It gave us more confidence, at the same time also more responsibility to extend the zone of peace and stability to that part of the world. So if it wasn't for the European Union, I would personally be probably the most pessimistic ambassador in town, and I still believe in it until my last breath as a catalyst of peace, security, stability, as a magnet, and a totally different now landscape in which we're talking about. And if it managed to solve the French-German question and brought peace and stability, and listen, if it does it for 27, we'll do it for the 28th, I think. So it's a good question. And we have still a lot of things to learn, of course, and it's an ongoing process. But you have standards. You have best practices. That's what we aspire to, and that's what's been happening. We are gaining sovereignty, not like the debate here, where the United Kingdom, it's almost in a crisis of sorts, and saying we're losing sovereignty. We are gaining sovereignty. We feel like we have gained more than that. So thank you.
Okay, thank you very much indeed. Could I just abuse my position in the chair just to make one comment? I haven't spoken up to now, but what we've heard this evening, both from our panelists and from members of the audience, is that there seems to be a consensus, and a long-standing consensus, that the EU and its EC and EU and its enlargement policies has been based on this notion of the idea of Europe and the values that Europe stands for in a normative and ethical way, as well as in the practices of conflict resolution and peace and stability that it may bring. But the further away we move from Rome and perhaps even Maastricht, the closer we come to a reality that a lot of members that wish to, or prospective members that wish to join the European Union, see the European Union not necessarily simply as a community of values or community of laws, but see Europe and the European Union as a market, as a regulatory state Europe. And so the Europe that they want to join is not necessarily the Europe that we want them to join, or at least we don't see it the same way. And perhaps the mismatch and the misfit and the misunderstandings that arise in terms of conditions and conditionality and in terms of what it is, what's at stake in terms of the enlargement process gets lost in this mismatch in terms of what we expect new members to come to the game with and what new prospective members want to bring to the game and what it means for them in terms of security, stability, peace, but also prosperity in a very minimalist way. So I think this is something which we need to take into account. It's a two-way process, and we look at it from within, but we have to look at it from without as well and see where the mismatch arises and what may come from this. Thank you all very much for attending this evening. I'd like to thank again the EU Parliament Information Office, the European Parliament Information Office, for sponsoring this evening. Please do come to the reception which follows now on the fifth floor of the old building in the senior common room. But most of all, please join me in thanking Lord Boswell and Sir Robert Cooper for sharing their thoughts with us.